fourth COVID shot is unlikely for most people. Now, the important thing is a fourth one of the one we have. What about an Omicron shot? That's a different story. And we're going to talk about that on today's bonus show. Number two, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be hearing a challenge to race conscious college admissions. These are elements of affirmative action. We're going to talk about it. Big, big case. And lastly, it shouldn't surprise us, after Republicans all voted against Joe Biden's COVID stimulus, they took credit for getting people money. And after voting against Joe Biden and Democrats' infrastructure bill, they are now taking credit for that infrastructure bill. Predictable. All on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, the inside from way out.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only Fat Beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What we have seen over the last 2 years is really total collapse of global cooperation and solidarity, period. I think there's absolutely no reason why a continent of Africa should be lagging behind with having 7% of the population fully immunized. A continent of 1.2 billion people is totally unacceptable. It's not the world that the humanity that we want to project.
As new cases of the highly infectious Omicron variant continue to climb in under-vaccinated parts of the world, we'll speak to the head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about how vaccine inequity will prolong the pandemic everywhere and lead to even more variants of the coronavirus. Then, to gangsters of capitalism, Smedley Butler, the Marines, and the making and breaking of America's empire.
The book tells the story that most Americans don't know about the way that America rose to imperial power in the first decades of the 20th century. And it's a book about how those wars have been forgotten here, how they're remembered all over the world, and how our imperial dealings have a way of coming back home in the form of fascism and authoritarianism.
We'll speak to author Jonathan Katz about the makings of U.S. empire, an effort to buy banking and business leaders to topple Franklin Delano Roosevelt's government in 1934 in order to establish a fascist dictatorship. The book also looks at the parallels between the 1934 attempted coup and the January 6th Capitol insurrection. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden said Tuesday he would consider personal sanctions against Russian President Vladimir Putin amidst mounting tensions over Ukraine. Russia has ordered a series of military drills as the U.S. and NATO build up their military presence in the region, and the U.S. announced plans to ensure adequate fuel supplies to Europe in the event of a Russian embargo. Meanwhile, Ukrainian leadership is warning against spreading panic, saying no decisive moves towards an incursion have been made. Some 100,000 Russian troops have been massed near the Ukrainian border for weeks. Biden addressed the escalating situation at a news conference Tuesday.
There will be enormous consequences if he were to go in and invade, as he could, the entire country, or a lot less than that as well, for Russia, not only in terms of economic consequences and political consequences, but it will be enormous consequences worldwide. This would be the largest, if he were to move in with all those forces, it would be the largest invasion since World War II. It would change the world.
The Intercept is reporting House Democrats are planning to fast-track a bill that would increase U.S. military aid to Ukraine by $500 million and provide military training to Ukrainian forces. This comes as political advisors from Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany are holding talks today in Paris. Germany has been more restrained than some of its European neighbors in response to the crisis, opposing sending weapons to Ukraine and warning against harsh sanctions on Russia. At least 23 people on an Australian ship carrying aid to Tonga have tested positive for COVID-19. Planes have been used to unload supplies for the volcano-stricken island nation amidst fears of spreading the coronavirus. So far, only one confirmed case has been reported in Tonga since the start of the pandemic. Meanwhile, in Australia, health authorities approved the Novavax vaccine for adults amidst an ongoing surge. It's expected to roll out next month. New Zealand's imposed its toughest restrictions yet after at least 9 Omicron cases were detected. In South Korea, COVID cases hit a new daily record of 13,000. China lifted its lockdown in the city of Xi'an this week, where 13 million residents had been ordered to stay at home since December 22nd. As part of China's zero COVID strategy, Beijing continues to report new daily cases, though overall numbers remain low as the Winter Olympics are set to kick off at the end of next week. Officials have sealed off Beijing neighborhoods near the games and have conducted mass testing of some 2 million people in the run-up to the event. Dozens of people associated with the Olympics have tested positive so far. In the Netherlands, officials are loosening restrictions despite record cases, allowing bars, restaurants, and theaters to reopen starting today. Ireland also recently removed most of its COVID curbs, including curfews on hospitality venues and requiring proof of vaccination for patrons. Ireland's prime minister credited the high uptake of boosters for preventing a worse outcome during the Omicron surge. In Saudi Arabia, millions of school children returned to in-person classes this week after nearly 2 years of remote learning, one of the longest school system shutdowns in the world. Cuba's pledge to donate 200 million doses of its COVID-19 vaccine to low-income countries in the global south. The move was announced at talks hosted by the Progressive International and was heralded as a possible historic turning point in the pandemic. Here in the U.S., nearly 3,000 COVID deaths were reported Tuesday, with 7-day averages for fatalities at their highest level since February 2021. On Tuesday, an appeals court judge temporarily stayed a ruling that struck down New York's indoor mask mandate just 1 day earlier. Governor Kathy Hochul's statewide mask mandate for all indoor public places will remain in effect as New York's attorney general files a formal appeal of Monday's decision. The Biden administration's withdrawing its vaccine or testing mandate for large companies following a Supreme Court decision earlier this month that blocked the requirement. Businesses will be subject to state and local laws on vaccinations, which vary widely across the country. In medical news, Pfizer-BioNTech launched their trial of an Omicron-specific vaccine. Meanwhile, the FDA withdrew emergency use authorization for COVID antibody drugs from Regeneron and Eli Lilly, saying they don't work against Omicron. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis slammed the move, threatening a possible lawsuit, even as the two affected drug companies do not dispute the findings, with Eli Lilly agreeing with the FDA decision. The White House labeled DeSantis's response as crazy. Jailed Native American leader Leonard Peltier has described prison as a torture chamber amidst constant coronavirus lockdowns. Peltier, who suffers from multiple health conditions, says he and others held at the Florida federal prison have yet to receive their COVID booster shots and describes worsening neglect and uncertainty. In a statement, Leonard Peltier writes, quote, "Left alone and without attention is like a torture chamber for the sick and old." The 77-year-old Peltier is the U.S.'s longest-serving political prisoner, convicted of killing 2 FBI agents on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975. He has long maintained his innocence. In Colombia, indigenous leader José Alberto Camayo was assassinated Monday in the region of Cauca. Camayo was a member of the Nasa people and one of the founders of the Indigenous Guard, an unarmed collective of land defenders. Indigenous leaders said a group of dissident members of the now demobilized Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, opened fire on them and community members after demanding respect for their people and territory. Among those involved in the attack is a man accused of murdering a 14-year-old indigenous Nasa environmentalist earlier this month. In Brazil, indigenous Pataxó protesters blocked a railroad Tuesday to mark 3 years since a dam collapsed in the state of Minas Gerais, killing some 270 community members. The dam was owned by the mining company Vale. protesters have vowed to continue the blockade until the mining company helps resettle them to a new territory, builds new homes, and starts paying reparations. This is an indigenous Potosho leader.
We are here on the train track, me with my people, claiming our territory. Vale has to give us another territory because our village is polluted with minerals. The water brought all those minerals to our water and to our houses. We ask people outside of Brazil and the UN for justice. Please intervene. Come help us. We are living here on the Vale Company train track. We have nowhere to go.
At least seven Bangladeshi refugees died of hypothermia after attempting to cross the Mediterranean on a boat from Libya to the Italian island of Lampedusa. Others were taken to the hospital to be treated for hypothermia and severe disorientation. Around 280 refugees were aboard the boat, most of them from Bangladesh and Egypt. At least 39 people are missing after their boat capsized off the coast of Florida Saturday. A man was rescued Tuesday after he was seen clinging to the hull of the sinking boat, which had departed from the Bahamas. Few details about the passengers are known. The Bahamas is frequently used as a transition point by migrants who are attempting to reach the United States for safety. Environmental groups have condemned a new bill moving through the Florida legislature that could effectively kill the state's rooftop solar market by making the sustainable energy source economically non-viable. The rooftop solar industry, solar panels, currently provides tens of thousands of jobs in Florida and brings in billions of dollars. The bill's backed by the state's largest electric utility, Florida Power and Light. In other news from Florida, a Republican-led state House committee has advanced legislation that would ban all discussions of sexual orientation and gender identity in schools. The bill would also allow parents to sue school districts for injunctive relief. Damages, attorney fees, and court costs if they believe schools have violated the measure. Critics have dubbed the legislation the Don't Say Gay Bill. And it will prohibit teachers from speaking about LGBTQ plus issues and harm the mental health of LGBTQ plus students. In Minnesota, the federal civil rights trial of three former police officers involved in the murder of George Floyd continues. In opening statements Monday, prosecutors argued that Thomas Lane, J. Alexander King, and Tu Tao were guilty of ignoring Floyd's repeated pleas of I can't breathe and failing to provide medical assistance as Derek Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes. Two of the officers also helped Chauvin physically restrain Floyd, while another officer prevented passersby from helping. A defense attorney, meanwhile, argued Chauvin was the one who called all of the shots. This is George Floyd's nephew, Brandon Williams, speaking Monday.
It was hard watching that video of my uncle begging and pleading for his life. And instead of raising up, turning them over, instead of even one of the officers saying, hey, this guy isn't breathing, let him up, they ignored that fact. They chose to kill him. We need some accountability.
The three officers also face a separate state trial for aiding and abetting the murder and manslaughter of George Floyd. Tennessee Congressmember Jim Cooper has become the 29th House Democrat to announce he will not seek re-election in this year's midterms. Cooper says he does not see how he could retain his seat after redistricting maps drawn up by state Republicans dismembered his Nashville hometown. And in related news, a panel of federal judges rejected Alabama's redrawn congressional districts this week, saying they discriminate against black voters and violate the Voting Rights Act. Alabama's Republican Attorney General has appealed the decision. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, as new cases of the highly infectious Omicron variant continue to climb in under-vaccinated parts of the world, we'll speak with the head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about how vaccine inequity is prolonging the pandemic. Stay with us.
To understand, choices made. You'll be fine. sun is cold. It's light and fair, and I'm falling down both sides. And I hear that song of those who love. I'm falling down both sides.
Both Sides of the Blade by Tindersticks. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, global health leaders are warning that new cases of the highly infectious Omicron variant continue to climb in under-vaccinated parts of the world. Only about 62% of the world's population has received at least one shot. And the divide between the rich and poor regions remains vast. This is World Health Organization Emergencies Director Mike Ryan speaking virtually at the World Economic Forum last week.
We look at in Africa, in our African regional office states, only 7%. So the reality is that the world is moving towards a 70% world. The problem is we are leaving huge swathes of the world behind.
The World Health Organization says the wide vaccine gap could set the stage for another dangerous variant to emerge. This comes as top African health officials say nearly 3 million vaccine doses have expired on the continent. They say many of the doses donated by COVAX in individual countries had short shelf lives and arrived with short notice. For more, we're joined by Dr. John Nkongasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, an institution of the African Union. He just wrote an op-ed in the New York Times headlined, "There Will Be Another Variant. Here's What the World Can Do Now." He last joined us from Addis Ababa. Today, he's in Washington, D.C. Dr. Nkongasong, welcome back to Democracy Now! So talk about the state of the world right now, and particularly the African continent when it comes to coronavirus, and what can be done now.
Well, thank you for having me again on the program. 2022 must be the year that we completely tip the balance in favor of increased vaccinations in the developing world, especially in Africa. As we speak, just about 10% of the population in Africa, a continent of 1.3 billion people, have been fully immunized. I think we have a gap and a journey to get to the 70% target, which the WHO has established. This is the year we must vaccinate at scale and at speed if we have to defeat the emergence of new variants. We saw what Omicron did. Omicron taught us a lesson that any threat anywhere in the world is a threat everywhere in the world. So we really have to scale up vaccination using all the assets that we have and in a more deliberate manner with stronger partnerships and collaboration across the board.
And Dr. Nkongasong, from the issues of accessibility to the testing infrastructure and vaccine equity, why do these continue to be some of the most pressing demands that we face, especially in areas like Africa?
So the first challenge the continent had was access to vaccines. If you recall, the continent last year had very limited access to vaccines, including the AstraZeneca doses that were bought by the COVAX mechanism. But because of the ban that India posed on it, the continent was left with very limited vaccines. Now we are beginning to see a shift in that narrative where more vaccines are arriving in the continent from COVAX, from the African Vaccine Acquisition Task Team, from bilateral donations like those offered by the United States government, which the continent is very appreciative. But we have to shift our focus now to vaccinating, that is, making sure vaccines that arrive at the airport actually get into the arm of the people. 80% of the population in Africa, 80% average, are willing to accept vaccines. There's a 20% minority that are hesitant, but we can work on that. But let's build the right alliances, partnerships to get the 80% of the population that is keen to be vaccinated. That is the only way we are going to save everyone everywhere in the world at the same time.
You also wrote in an op-ed piece for the New York Times recently. It was headlined, "There will be another variant. Here's what the world can do now." What are some of the steps that need to be taken now? Because, as you say, inevitably there will be more variants.
There are a couple of things that the world must do, and do that collectively, not sequentially. One is to scale up vaccination. We've discussed that. Second is to test. We need to make sure that we decentralize testing and make sure that the communities lead and own testing. Thirdly, we need to increase our ability to monitor for these variants so that as they emerge, we know what what exactly they are, what their properties are, and then take action. And of course, make sure that that is linked to access to new drugs. We have new regimens that are out there, like the Paxlovid and other drugs. We should make sure that they are accessible so that when people are tested and they are positive, they get linked to treatment centers. And lastly, let's not let down our guards on the prevention measures. The prevention measures against that we've used all through this pandemic, wearing of masks, avoiding large gatherings, work against all variants. Those must be maintained. Those are the key things that we need to do in 2022 and do all of it collectively.
I wanted to ask you about Moderna's chair and co-founder, Noubar Afeyan, who was asked about patents by CNN's Vareed Zakaria in an interview last month.
Let me ask you about this. A lot of people are saying you guys should be giving this technology away, waiving all your intellectual patents. Explain what Moderna's position on this is. As I understand it, you are willing to say you will not enforce patents as long as COVID is around.
Well, Fareed, the first time we spoke was around the time a year ago when we voluntarily pledged, the only company to have done that, voluntarily pledged not to enforce our patents against anybody who uses our patents to make a vaccine against the pandemic. At that time, there had been no proof that the vaccine will work. But we did that because we thought it's the right thing to do from a vaccine access standpoint. We believe that that has enabled others to make mRNA vaccines. And if others do that even further, that's great.
So that's Moderna's chair and co-founder. But Dr. Nkangasong, there's a difference between not suing a company for taking their recipe and revealing what that recipe, that formula is, so that companies around the world could manufacture it and make it available on the continent of Africa, in Asia, throughout the world. You have written and spoke about this at the World Economic Forum last week when you said that during the pandemic, we've seen a shameful collapse of global solidarity and cooperation. Can you talk about what these companies that have made billions of dollars paid for in their in the research for them, in the case of Moderna by U.S. taxpayers, Pfizer because of its profits, paid for by the people, but not sharing these formulas? What effect has this had?
So we are living in an unprecedented time and dealing with a crisis that we've not witnessed for the last close to 100 years. So that means the solidarity that I've always been a champion of has to be in play. Solidarity that says that we need to bring all assets to the table to enable increase availability or access of vaccines, including transfer of technology and rights and support for countries and regions to be able to manufacture vaccines so that the issue of limited access to vaccines is overcome. We are very encouraged that our countries like the United States have already taken a position that favors that. We hope other developed countries would do the same. I'm also very encouraged that about 10 countries in Africa have now embarked on the journey of producing vaccines in their respective countries. Countries like South Africa, Rwanda, Senegal, Morocco, Egypt have all taken on that responsibility to produce vaccines in Africa. And that is very welcome and they should be supported.
And Doctor, I wanted to ask you this whole issue of the number of shots that would that would protect one from COVID. We're now seeing in countries like Israel now recommending a second booster. We're talking about four shots in a period of about a year. It's not really logistically possible for the world to keep up this kind of a vaccination program. What is your sense of what needs to be done by the manufacturers of vaccines in the future?
Again, it goes back to where the discussion we just had a few seconds ago, which is increased access to vaccines. And hopefully that the new generation vaccines will actually enable us to have the need to have the second, third, and fourth dose less. I think, but the issue we have in our hands right now is how do we even get people that are struggling to get one shot to get that one shot? And how do we push or enable people that have received their only one shot to get their two shots? So in Africa, I think the problem needs to be contextualized so that we know exactly that you just cannot be aiming at the third and the fourth shot in Africa where you don't even have access to the first shot of the vaccine. So I think that is key. We should focus on vaccinating at scale, vaccinating at speed, especially in areas where there are limited vaccinations.
What do you know of a variant coming out of Cameroon that has also affected France, Doctor?
We have had very limited information on that that variant, and we have not seen any published data on that, and we hope truly remain hopeful that that is truly not a variant of concern.
And can you also talk about the expired vaccines, what it means when you get millions of vaccines in Africa? And really, let's look at those numbers. You have NPR reporting that you have much of the midsection of Africa, including powerful economic and political players like Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal, all under 2% vaccination rates. Away from Africa, you've got 10%. People haven't gotten about 10% COVID vaccine coverage like Syria, Afghanistan, Haiti.
Yeah, any vaccine that expires is very painful because that is potentially a life save. And, but we should go beyond that and say, what are the reasons that vaccines are expiring in Africa? The first major reason is that those vaccines arrive with a very short lifespan, which is what you call the expiring date. So we have issued some guidance to any donations that vaccines that are intended to be shipped to the continent should have at least a longer expiring date, at least 3 months to 6 months, so that the countries can prepare to use the vaccines then. Overall, about 0.5% of all vaccines that have arrived the continent have expired. But again, I want to be very sure that I'm clear on this. Any expired vaccines that are on the continent is painful because that is potentially a life that could be saved.
And could you talk about what some of the countries in Africa have gotten right in their efforts to prevent the spread of COVID, especially given the experience some had coping with the Ebola epidemics in the past?
The continent has used several previous experiences in fighting the COVID pandemic, including mobilizing the community. I mean, at the Africa CDC, we've deployed over 18,000 community healthcare workers in several countries that do door-to-door engagement, human contacts, counseling, and spreading of helping the contact tracing early on in the pandemic. The second thing the continent has done very, very well is really a cooperation. They've set up mechanisms like the African Vaccine Acquisition Task Team, which is a great symbol of intercontinental cooperation, collaboration, which has enabled the continent to secure over 450 million doses of vaccines. That is remarkable. It is the first time in the history of a disease that the continent has come together that much under this very strong political leadership of President Cyril Ramaphosa when he was chair of the African Union. So such experiences must be maintained and must be operationalized and institutionalized so that we can use such instruments to fight other pandemics in the future and also to fight the existing endemic diseases. Let's not forget that malaria, tuberculosis, and HIV are still very serious threats in Africa.
Yes, let's follow up on that. Dr. Nkangasong, you're not only the director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but you are also nominated by President Biden for Ambassador at Large and Coordinator of the U.S. Government Activities to Combat AIDS, HIV globally. If you can talk about how the pandemic has affected these other diseases and populations dealing with, for example, TB, HIV, AIDS, et cetera.
No, thank you. I'm truly grateful to President Biden for the nomination, but it still has to be confirmed. So once that confirmation occurs, I'll be at ease to speak more about the HIV panel. But let me just very broadly say that the disruption that COVID has had on the continent on and impacted other diseases is huge. I mean, there's no doubt about that. We have evidence from the Global Fund that clearly shows that services geared towards malaria, tuberculosis, and HIV have been severely disrupted. So I think that is what pandemics do. When you restrain people from moving, when you restrain and disrupt supply chain management, the overall impact is that there's a lot of severe impact on non-COVID-related affections.
And I wanted to ask you, during the pandemic, wealthier nations like the United Kingdom have relied on African doctors and nurses to shore up their health services. You're calling on many of these doctors and nurses and health workers to return to Africa. Could you talk about this issue of the brain drain and of the basically the use of medical people trained in other countries by the wealthier nations?
Absolutely. We learned a huge lesson during this pandemic where we set up the African Task Force for COVID Response, which is an intercontinental task force that coordinates the response and report to the level of the head of states. And it was very interesting that so many Africans in the diaspora were willing to contribute and contributed significantly to the different technical working groups that were set up within this task force. So that suggested to us that if the African Union and Africa CDC would set up a deliberate program that would enable Africans who are in the diaspora to contribute their skill sets and experiences on the continent, it would be a remarkable return on investment, and that will enable them to at least help the continent that has very limited human resources for health to actually use that and address the challenges that they have. So we are looking into that very, very seriously.
Dr. Nkangasong, we want to thank you very much for being with us. You're usually in Africa, born in Cameroon, but you're in Washington, D.C. right now. What do you find coming to the United States, the difference in how the people of the United States are dealing with their attitudes toward how the government is dealing with Omicron, but overall coronavirus and the African continent?
I think we have to admit that the Omicron variant is truly a lesson that it's a very difficult pandemic. It's a difficult virus we're dealing with. It's a virus that mutates very quickly. It's a virus that, if you allow it to mutate, to circulate, is going to create a mutation and challenge even the vaccination efforts that we've had in the world. I think we are very encouraged to see the leadership role that the United States is playing in making vaccines accessible to Africa. The United States has donated most vaccines now in Africa, and the continent, I can speak on behalf of the African Union, is eternally grateful for that. So that increased solidarity and leadership expressed by the United States in solving this problem globally is really going to be needed going forward.
We want to thank you for being with us, Dr. John Nkangasong, founding director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, an institution of the African Union, recently nominated by President Biden for Ambassador at Large and coordinator of the U.S. government activities to combat AIDS, HIV globally. If confirmed, he would be the first person of African origin to hold the post. We will link to the New York Times op-ed that Dr. Nkangasong wrote, headlined, "There Will Be Another Variant. Here's What the World Can Do Now." Coming up, We will look at both the January 6th House Committee and federal prosecutors, what they're finding when it comes to the Capitol insurrection, and how that relates to a fascinating new book, Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, The Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire. Stay with us. Entre el orden y la patria, oxigéname de libertad, de lucha y de templanza. Hijo de la rabia, hermano, compañero, que la historia es nuestra y la hacen los pueblos.
Hijo de la rebeldía con su ley, bajo la suerte de un falso rey, que la calle sabe la que es.
Tocar a mi puerta, me dijo tómalo con calma, ordena las penas. No es depresión, solo capitalismo. Que todo está hecho para sentirse muy perdido. Es un laberinto, se pierde el equilibrio. Que hay muchas luces oscureciendo contenido. Pero qué normal, que a todo nos pasa. Nos quieren drogados pegados a la pantalla. Me dijo, escoge tu batalla. Que la convicción es más alta que las montañas. Que la verdad demora, pero siempre estalla.
Child of the Rebellion by Anna Tijoux. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the January 6th House Committee and federal prosecutors continue investigation into last year's deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol and Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the election, we turn to look at a largely forgotten effort to topple the U.S. government in the past. It was 1934. Some of the nation's most powerful bankers and business leaders plotted to overthrow President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in order to block the New Deal and establish a fascist dictatorship. The coup plotters included the head of General Motors, Alfred P. Sloan, as well as J.P. Morgan Jr., and the former president of DuPont, Irenae DuPont. The men asked the celebrated Marine Corps officer, Smedley Butler, to lead a military coup. But Butler refused and revealed what he knew to members of Congress. This is a clip of General Smedley Butler speaking in 1934.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. The plan as outlined to me was to form an organization of veterans, to use as a bluff or as a club at least, to intimidate the government and break down our democratic institutions. The upshot of the whole thing was that I was supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government. I talked with an investigator for this committee who came to me with a subpoena on Sunday, November 18th. He told me they had unearthed evidence linking my name with several such veteran organizations. As it then seemed to me to be getting serious, I felt it was my duty to tell all I knew of such activities to this committee. My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institution. I want to retain the right to vote, the right to speak freely, and the right to write. If we maintain these basic principles, our democracy is safe. No dictatorship can exist with suffrage, freedom of speech, and press.
At the time, Marine Major General Smedley Butler was one of the most celebrated Marine officers in the country, having played key roles in U.S. invasions and occupations across the globe, including in Cuba, Nicaragua, Puerto Rico, Haiti, Mexico, and the Philippines. But Smedley Butler later spoke out against U.S. imperialism, famously writing, "War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many," Butler said. We're joined now by the award-winning author Jonathan Katz, author of the new book Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, The Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire. Also the author of The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Jonathan. This is a fascinating book. I mean, for people who don't know about, for example, this attempted coup of 1934, can you talk more about exactly how it unfolded? The parallels to these days are quite interesting, but let's start with the original story that took place, what, like 90 years ago?
Yeah, so it actually starts in 1933. A representative of a prominent Wall Street brokerage house named Gerald C. McGuire starts trying to recruit Smedley Butler to, it actually starts out as a kind of an internal plot to get him to speak against Franklin D. Roosevelt taking the dollar off the gold standard at an American Legion conference in Chicago, but it broadens from there. And by 1934, McGuire is sending Butler postcards from the French Riviera, where he's just arrived from fascist Italy, from Berlin. And then he comes to Butler's hometown of Philadelphia and asks him to lead a column of 500,000 World War I veterans up Pennsylvania Avenue for the purpose of intimidating Franklin Delano Roosevelt into either resigning outright or handing off all his executive powers to a all-powerful, unelected cabinet secretary who the plotters who are backing McGuire were going to name.
And Jonathan, didn't Butler also claim, in addition to these corporate leaders, that there were folks like Prescott Bush involved in this, the father of George Herbert Walker Bush and grandfather of George W. Bush?
So it's actually there's actually a kind of a game of broken telephone going on with his name being involved in this. So Prescott Bush was actually too much involved with the actual Nazi Party in Germany to be involved with the business plot. Bush was a partner at Brown Brothers Harriman, which is still a major investment bank based in New York, across the street from Zuccotti Park, their headquarters. And Brown Brothers Harriman was the subject of a different investigation by the same congressional committee, because that committee's ambit was to investigate all forms of sort of fascist influence and all attempts to, you know, subvert American democracy. And because Brown Brothers was part of a separate investigation, they end up sort of in the same folder at the National Archives, and then it ends up sort of getting mixed up in a documentary that came out about 10 years ago. So that's actually a misunderstanding. Butler never brought up Prescott Bush's name, but it was because Prescott Bush was too involved with the actual Nazis to be involved with something that was so homegrown as the business plot.
And in terms of why they were recruiting Butler, his importance in the early and mid 20th century as a military hero, could you talk about that as well?
Yeah. So Butler was, he was the Zelig. He was like the Forrest Gump of American imperialism in the early 20th century. He joined the Marines in 1898. He lied about his age. He was 16 years old. And he joined to fight in, the Spanish-American War, the Spanish-Cuban-American War, against Spanish imperialism in Cuba. But from there, he rides a wave of imperial war, and he's everywhere. He's in the Philippines. He invades China twice. He helps seize the land for the Panama Canal. He overthrows governments in Nicaragua, in Haiti. He invades the Dominican Republic, et cetera. He's also a general during World War I. And so he had this very, very long and renowned resume in the Marine Corps. He was twice the recipient of the Medal of Honor that made him a big star in America. And he was also, he had a reputation as being sort of a Marines general. Like he was somebody who you know, had the deep and abiding respect of his enlisted men. And because of that resume of having overthrown a lot of democracies overseas and also having, you know, the loyalty of so many members of the Marine Corps, that for the best as we can tell is why Jerry Maguire and his and probably his boss Grayson Murphy went to Butler to lead their putsch.
Now, we want to get into this early history because it is fascinating. When you know, mention the Philippines, when you mention Cuba and Puerto Rico, people are not really aware, most people, I think, of what the U.S. role was. But just on this plot in 1934, what did General Motors and J.P. Morgan have to do with this? What was the Liberty League, and how far did this go?
So the reason why we know about the Liberty League's involvement is because Jerry Maguire, who is the representative of this Wall Street firm, tells Butler at this meeting in 1934 that very soon a organization is going to emerge to back the putsch. And he describes them as being sort of the villagers in the opera, that they would sort of be operating behind the scenes. And a couple weeks later, on the front page of the New York Times, this new organization is announced, the Liberty League, and it is started by the DuPonts, Alfred P. Sloan, all of the people that you just mentioned, and is also directly connected to Maguire, the guy who's recruiting Butler, because his boss, Grayson M.P. Murphy, who is really, I think, the linchpin of this thing, is the treasurer of the Liberty League. And what the Liberty League was it was basically a consortium of extremely wealthy capitalists, industrialists, who hated Franklin Roosevelt. They also had the involvement of two former Democratic presidential candidates, Al Smith and John W. Davis, who were anti-New Deal Democrats. And basically, you know, their public-facing goal, and they were very open about this, was to dismantle the New Deal, which FDR was trying to use to save, you know, Americans, to put millions of Americans back to work and save Americans from the Depression. What we don't know is how far the more senior members of the Liberty League, like the DuPonts, had gotten in the planning. And the reason why we don't know is because the congressional committee that Butler testifies in front of, which is headed by John W. McCormack, who goes on to become the longtime Speaker of the House, Samuel Dickstein, who was a Democrat of New York, they cut their investigation short. The only people who testify are Butler, a newspaper reporter who Butler's enlisted in sort of an independent investigation, Jerry Maguire, and the lawyer for one of the maybe lower level industrialists who's behind this, the heir to the Singer sewing machine fortune. And so absent that, you know, more detailed investigation, we just don't know, you know, the extent to which, you know, the DuPonts, for instance, actually were involved in the planning of a business plot. They may have already been fully involved and just stopped planning once Butler blew the whistle, or it's possible that you know, Murphy hadn't gotten them involved yet. We just can't say.
And what was the reaction of the press at the time to the claims of Butler? And it might be instructive given the things that we're going through today.
Yeah, it was ridicule. So, you know, this was big news at the time. You know, the story ran on the front page of the New York Times, but the Times, you know, they kind of divided it in half, and half of the column inches on the front were, you know, just sort of these like hilarious denials by the accused. Time Magazine, which was, you know, owned by Henry Luce, you know, the billionaire son of missionaries to China. You know, ran sort of satirical piece mocking Butler. The Times, you know, mocked Butler further in an unsigned editorial. It was basically peals of laughter. And a couple months later, once the committee had issued its final report, again, they didn't do a full investigation, but they did enough to say that they were able to, in their words, verify all the pertinent statements made by General Butler, and that you know, something was planned and may have been put into action at such a time as the plotters, however many there were, saw fit, that conclusion got far, far less attention. And, you know, to a certain extent, you know, it severely damaged, I would say, Butler's, you know, reputation in, you know, among the establishment, among the American elite. And, you know, it sort of helped consign the business plot to, you know, the maybe not the dustbin, but kind of the forgotten marginalia of American history.
So this is critical. I mean, you're talking about them fighting FDR, calling him a socialist, the New Deal, and then jump forward almost a century to today. Talk about the parallels you see with the Capitol insurrection and beyond that.
Yeah, the parallels are legion, no pun intended. I mean, so one thing, one clear set of parallels is that Gerald McGuire, who's the bond salesman who tries to recruit Butler, one of the places that he went in Europe in 1934 to gain inspiration for this plot. Again, it was a totally homegrown thing, but he was looking to fascist movements in Europe for inspiration, was to Paris, where 6 weeks before McGuire arrived in Paris, there was a riot of far right and fascist groups. They tried to storm the parliament in Paris to prevent the handover of power to a center left prime minister. They were animated by a crazy conspiracy theory, an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. That involved somebody who had committed suicide, sort of, you know, there was a conspiracy that he hadn't really killed himself. And that group, one of the groups that participated in that riot, called the Croix de Feu, or the Fiery Cross, was, in McGuire's terms, exactly the sort of organization that he wanted Butler to lead. You know, you look at that. That is one of the closest historical parallels to what happened on January 6th, you know, sort of a motley assortment of groups, some of which hate each other, others are kind of unaligned, but they're all sort of working together in this effort to overthrow a democracy, prevent the transfer of power to a center-left prime minister who they see as, you know, a stalking horse for communism or socialism. And really, I mean, that's one of the closest historical antecedents, and there are many others, including, you know, the fact that it was a fascist coup being, you know, plotted in the United States, you know, to overthrow American democracy at a time when liberal democracy was seen by a lot of people as being on the way out, and you know, we see the same things here today.
And Jonathan, if you could just briefly, you know, in a few seconds, give us a sense of how a Butler changed from being a soldier of imperialism to an anti-imperialist. What were what caused him to have this transformation?
Yeah, I mean, so that was really like the central question that I was trying to answer for myself in writing Gangsters of Capitalism. I would say that there wasn't one single moment. To a certain extent, Butler's kind of returning to his roots. Among other fascinating things about the guy, he's a Quaker from Philadelphia's Main Line, and he gets into, you know, his first war at the age of 16, fighting against imperialism and tyranny. And to a certain extent, over the course of his career, he sees that the primary beneficiaries of his and his Marines' interventions are the banks, are Wall Street, are American politicians. And then he sees the ways in which, imperialism abroad gets re-imported as authoritarianism and fascism at home. And that's really why he ends up spending the last 10 years of his life, you know, decrying the military-industrial complex, writing war as a racket, and trying, and of course failing, to prevent the outbreak of World War II and the United States' entry into it.
Well, we want to thank you so much, Jonathan Katz, for joining us, award-winning journalist, author. His latest book, Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, the Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire. His writings appear on theracket.news. And before we go, Juan, I just wanted to say congratulations. The documentary that you are featured in, which is called Takeover, directed by Emma Frances Snyder, has just been shortlisted for Academy Award. The documentary follows the 12 historic hours on July 14, 1970, when members of the Young Lords, which included Juan at the time, took over the rundown Lincoln Hospital in the South Bronx. The Young Lords were the radical group founded by Puerto Ricans, modeled on the Black Panther Party in New York, co-founded by Juan Gonzalez, Democracy Now! Co-host. They drove out the administrative staff, barricaded the entrances of the hospital, made their cries for decent health care name known to the world. This is the trailer. Listen carefully and see if you can pick out Juan's voice.
Is a story from New York, not the New York of Manhattan Broadway, but from perhaps the toughest square mile in the city, in the South Bronx.
I was 14 years old when I joined the Young Lords. The Young Lords were a street gang that became politicized by the Black Panther Party.
We became visible as servants of the people.
One of our targets was Lincoln Hospital.
That building was condemned 25 years ago. Condemned for rich people and opened up for poor people.
It was a place that you went to die.
Lincoln was called the butcher shop.
Blood stains on the walls, blood stains on the floors.
And there was a rat in the emergency room.
We have seen children get lead poisoning while hospitalized at Lincoln Hospital.
So we felt now is the time for us to say exactly how we're going to respond to the killings of our people.
Our plan was to take over Lincoln Hospital.
We have to begin to stand up as the people, the Puerto Rican people, and say, that's enough. That's enough.
We have been asking for changes to take place. And you've paid no attention to us. You've thrown us out of your offices. And you've called the cops on us. And now we're putting you out. You've taken over a hospital. We're going to run it. You're out. And I will walk you to your car.
We immediately announced that we were not leaving until the city made a firm commitment to build a new hospital.
From El Barrio to Arecibo, Palante.
About 1,000 police were en route with high-powered rifles. They had vans all over the place.
If the police came in, it was going to be a bloodbath because the police hated the Young Lords.
We were terrified.
To all who had to hide, I say, Palante.
Power to the people means, including people, to gain control of their destiny.
The Young Lords were ahead of our time in terms of recognizing that healthcare is a right.
We wanted a revolutionary change to the health system in this country, and we still do.
No oppressor, it's invincible.
So that's the trailer for Takeover. Again, just shortlisted for an Academy Award. It's up for nomination. The judges are deciding now. Juan, we did a segment on this that I encourage people to go to. But in these last minute we have your response to this recognition. It's nominated in the documentary shorts category.
Well, I mean, it's clearly great news. I'm still amazed that there's been so much interest in what we did as youngsters more than 50 years ago. And I hope that some of the lessons of what we did right and what we did wrong will resonate with younger people these days.
Well, again, congratulations. And that film is called, the documentary short is called Takeover. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Has job openings. You can go to democracynow.org to learn about the applications for Human Resources Manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. A very happy birthday, belated birthday to Chirina Nadura. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Faust, Mike Burke, Dina Gusta, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Chirina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The pose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. In the late 18th century, the English term mudlark was a rather grim one. It referred to people who scavenged for usable debris in the cold, stinking, tidal mud of a river because they didn't have any other means of income. Today, mudlarking is more of a hobby, and it's the subject of a book I'm really enjoying by Laura Makelam. It's called Mudlark, In Search of London's Past Along the River Thames. It turns out that much of the River Thames is tidal, which means that twice a day it pulls back to reveal its secrets. And Makelam has found all kinds of things over the years, everything from ancient Roman jewelry to modern engraved wedding rings. And you got to wonder how somebody lost that, or maybe they got angry and threw it in the river. But there's so much history in each one of those objects. One of my favorite examples is the fact that she's always finding these little clay pipes. So I'm talking about tiny clay pipes. And the reason they were tiny is because tobacco was initially very expensive when it was first brought to Britain. And she also finds a lot of Elizabethan-style pins because in those days everybody was having to pin their clothes. And she's even found Mesolithic flints. And Grant, I know that will appeal to you because you've talked before about just what that feeling must be like of picking up something that you know has only been touched by a human thousands of years ago.
Oh, yeah. But I'm also interested in those ancient one-hitters. Any modern vapor or pot smoker would recognize that.
Yeah, these are little bitty clay pipes.
Oh, that's a lovely book. It sounds wonderful. Can we talk more about this later? Because I have some stuff to toss in.
Oh, great. I do, too. It reminds me of the kind of stuff we do on the show, of course. You know, we see that little glint in the mud and we follow an object story or a word story.
Yeah, an object has a story, connects us to history and to other people. It is in itself interesting. A word is interesting, but it's part of a larger fabric, a larger culture, a larger civilization, right? It's not its own thing. It's always about context. We'd love to hear about the hobbies and the pastimes of your life and the language that belongs to them. We'd also like to hear about what you're reading and any particularly beautiful passages that you think the world needs to hear. Hit us up, words@waywardradio.org. Talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD. Of course, you can always call us 24 hours a day, toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 877-929-9673. Hello, welcome to Away with Words.
Hi, this is Barney. I'm calling from Carmel, Indiana.
Hi, Barney. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Around the holidays, when we are cutting Christmas snowflakes out of paper, as lots of kids do at this time of year in school projects and otherwise, when you're folding them all up and cutting all those little squares and circles out of them, and then we would make a big mess on the floor, and my mom would ask us to clean it up, and she called all that detritus on the floor, clean up all the schnittles. And I never really knew what that word meant. And we've all said it. She also referred to schnittles as when you tear notebook paper out of a spiral-bound notebook and all those little pieces of paper that snowflakes fall on the ground. We always called those schnittles. I sort of had forgotten the word, and it kind of popped back into my head again. And I happened to be listening to your show when the word popped back in, and I thought it an excuse to call.
Great. Is she of German extraction by any chance?
She is. It's from my mom's side of the family. The family, I believe, hails from mostly from Luxembourg or has descent in Luxembourg, but it's between Germany and France.
Are you originally from Carmel or from somewhere else? Maybe closer to Chicago or even Wisconsin?
I was born in Chicago, grew up in the suburbs of Chicago.
I ask because I can hear it in your vowels.
Yes, I am a Chicago boy.
Chris, paying attention to your vowels.
It has nothing to do whatever with schnittles. It's just your vowels.
Yeah, it sounds like schnittles is a variant of a more common term for those little bitty scraps, which is schnibbel. And it comes from the German word schnippel, which means simply a scrap, S-C-H-N-I-P-P-E-L in the German, and S-C-H-N-I-B-B-L-E in English,